It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls, where artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And today's show is going to be about really the amazing mobility of dancers to do things that really seem to defy gravity and other laws of physics as well. But in reality, those very principles are what contribute to the ability to create that illusion. And with me is Cynthia Pratt, professor of dance at Butler University. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Mark. Nice to be here.
You too. And Dr. Andy Gameron, who's associate professor of physics at IUPUI. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
So this is one of the shows that I always have been looking forward to because I love dance myself so much. And dance, I think, is one of the things sometimes that's misunderstood by people. They get so used to the classical form of dance, or they see popular form, and they don't really understand that there's a lot that goes into being able to make those movements.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the saying is that it takes 10 years of intense training to make a professional dancer.
Whether you're modern, classical, or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's, yeah, I mean, I would say for some of the, I would say for classical dance, it would probably be, well, I'd say a good 10 years, yeah, 10, or more, yeah.
That's probably about the same as it is for physics. I mean, if you figure an undergraduate degree and a doctoral degree, that's about 10 years.
There you go. Of course, you know, with dance, you have to start, you really have to start your professional training before you're 10 years old.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Right. And physicists can be really old.
Yeah.
They end their career. Dancers, well, they can still teach and there are other things and they can move gracefully.
Absolutely.
And beautifully.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I'm really interested, Cynthia, because it does take a while. And isn't a lot of that just learning to control your body, to control where your center of mass is, to be aware of your body in space? Is that what a lot of it is?
Oh, you know, that the center of the, your center of gravity, that is a very big, that's a very big concern in dance training. Absolutely. And also the push and pull away from gravity is very, very important to understand. That's what we work with. You know, we always talk about the floor being our best friend, but actually what we're talking about is the pull of gravity and how we are shaping that to make the movements we make.
Yeah. And Andy, can you describe a little bit when I talk about center of gravity or technically probably would be center of mass. But when we talk about that, what are we talking about?
So actually center of mass is, essentially, it's the place about which you would balance. If you think about a long, skinny object, it's easy. It's kind of near the middle. Now, if the object is heavier on one side, the center of mass is closer to that side. And for a three-dimensional object, the center of mass is somewhere that would balance around all different ways of rotating. So if a dancer, for instance, is being held aloft by their partner, the partner's hand has to be right under the person's center of mass. Otherwise, they would tip over one way or another.
Which does happen.
Yes, it does, I'm sure.
there's a lot of trial and error there.
And the difference between center of mass and center of gravity, actually, this is one of those things. Sometimes people make a big deal out of it, but near the surface of the Earth, it never matters. The center of gravity is identical to the center of mass as long as you're in a gravitational field that's uniform. And anywhere near the surface of the Earth, that's going to be true. If you're near a black hole or something, well, now we can talk about something more complex.
That's great
to know. Black hole dancing, that's for some future shows.
Yeah.
And that'd be some kind of dance. Oh, yeah. A black hole.
This is really interesting to me because, you know, we, like I said, we are very concerned with where our center is. This is what we struggle with so much, and what muscular tension and release you have to use around that center of gravity and or center of mass, whichever one
you want.
Right. And, you know, for us, we think of it being just probably just above our pelvic floor, and that we're using the hips. The hip sockets to sort of have that interplay between where the pelvis is going to be centered on the legs.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that's one thing when you're standing or fully stretched out.
Right, when you're just
the center
up.
Of mass shifts around a bit as you, if you were, in, for instance, were to tuck up your legs. Is that something that plays a big role?
Yeah. I mean, you, of course, the you're either standing on 2 feet or you're standing on 1 foot. If you're going to talk about being vertical, if you're going to be talking about standing. And so that's a very big thing on how you shift your center to be on one leg as opposed to be on two legs. Mm-hmm. That's a very, very big thing because most people shift if you're in an untrained way without thinking. If someone said stand on one leg, they would lean to get the counterbalance. Uh-huh. And we shift at the level of the greater trochanter on your femur. Mm-hmm. We shift that, so the whole pelvic floor shifts over the supporting leg, which is how you do when you're walking naturally. Your pelvis has that shift side to side at that level of the pelvic floor. Right. And your center shifts. But then when someone asks you to do that, say in a dance class, then all of a sudden you go into all these unnatural machinations. So because you don't realize how simple and natural that is.
So there's a lot of untraining at the very beginning. Is that
exactly? Yeah.
Yeah, you have to untrain.
Fascinating. In physics, untraining is also important. Because there are ideas that people have about the way things work that, again, can get in the way of learning the formalism of how we actually describe the way things work in physics.
That could be, that exact statement could be so applied to a dancer, you know, about unlearning and how they imagine things to work when in actuality it's very different. Yeah, it's very applicable.
So Mark, this is just, our thousandth example of how art and science really are very similar in a lot of ways.
Oh my goodness. I mean, it really is. You know, what you have, Cynthia, too, is you train for endurance, you train muscles. Those are all important because I would think you begin, as any of us, when we get tired, when accidents occur, or we can't control our body anymore.
Right.
Because we don't have that power, you know, and we start getting out of alignment. We start doing the things we're not supposed to do.
Well, you know, this is what's interesting and that's distinguished about dance as opposed to a sport is that when we have that interplay between contracting and releasing muscles, it's for expressivity, not only for strength and endurance. It's also you have to know how you are going to express a role or an emotion. And that has a lot to do with how you're holding your body and your posture and what kind of dynamics you have in your movement. And all of that takes a certain muscular control and coordination.
Wow. What always amazes me are when somebody does a pirouette, and I've seen them do it also in skating.
Uh-huh.
Would think about that. But Andy, there's some really hardcore physics happening in that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it starts with having an axis of rotation. And that axis of rotation has to end at the floor on 1 foot.
Mm.
And then you don't want to wobble too much. So your center of mass has to be aligned on that axis somehow. But then there's the question of how fast you spin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've all seen this, and we see it both in with dancers and, as you mentioned, with skaters, and also in a different direction with divers, which is that when you when, for instance, a dancer is spinning, pirouetting on a toe with arms outstretched, and then they bring their arms in close to their body, their rate of spin accelerates.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's a principle that physicists know as conservation of angular momentum.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot about a pirouette. Pirouettes are very complex movements. And one of the things that in dance you say a pirouette is a turn is only as good as its preparation. And the preparation is really important because you have this, we usually do, the traditional way to do, say, a pirouette is from what we call fourth position, where one foot is turned out in front and the back foot is also turned out, so but they're apart. And you feel, you have to center your weight between those 2 feet. And then you have to sort of dig into the floor first. You have the plie, which is like takes you down to the floor. And then you feel the rotators at the top of your hips take that leg up and out. And that force of the leg going out and then spinning on that axis is what makes the pirouette. So you have you have this rotation, and then you have this grounding that happens as you push into the floor, and then you push away from the floor up that center, and then that knee pulls you back, and that's what spins you. And then of course you have the head spotting, where you snap your head around. So it's all of these things. It takes a long, long time to learn all of those steps to get to the final pirouette. It's not just a turn by any stretch. You really work up to that.
Oh yeah, no, that's fascinating. I think, Mark, we needed to have somebody, an anatomy person here as well.
I think so.
This is also interesting because, you know, of course I could go on with this subject for a million years, but you know, that you have to feel the alignment of your torso too, because what you were talking about, Andy, where you have the arms, you know, the centrifugal force that pulls your arms away from you, you also have to hold your rib cage close to your center, or else if your rib cage splays, it's going to take you off your balance, because right, the centrifugal force of just is going to be pulling on your torso too. So you have to keep the torso as tight in that vertical dimension as possible.
Yeah, that's what I was saying about not wobbling.
Right, right.
Because if you get your center off the axis that you started on, then you're just going to wobble and it's going to look really bad.
That's right. And then if you go into the more contemporary techniques, all the turns are off the axis, which is really tough. Mm-hmm. If you've learned to turn on that axis and then all of a sudden you have to do it where you're bending forward, say,
mm-hmm. Right.
You know, that's really tough.
I can't imagine even starting to try it. I would be on the floor. Not
well, if you had, you know, this is why we start where we start and work our way up.
Yeah. You mentioned the head snap, which I've seen. And yeah, I remember when I was in high school, a friend of mine was taking a dance class and I went to just to watch.
Uh-huh.
And I saw the instructor demonstrating. And demonstrating that, and I saw that head snap. It wasn't even what he was talking about, but I noticed it and I thought, wow, that is just a really clever way of using your own anatomy so that you can do something that's actually very difficult without getting injured, really.
Yeah, it keeps you from getting dizzy.
Yeah, it keeps you from getting dizzy because your head isn't spinning, it's just snapping around, and you can keep your eye on a distant spot so that you can orient yourself. You're not getting confused about which way you're going or where you're headed.
Right. Yeah, it does. It's you look in the way you learn it is mm-hmm. you look into your own eyes in the mirror, mm-hmm. and then you slowly just sort of walk your body around, and then you snap your head around and you look in your own eyes again, you find your eyes again.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, and then you keep doing that and keep doing that. And then you have to, of course, do it the other side. So it's, you work up to it too.
Mark, this is one of the shows that I really wish we had not just radio.
Visuals.
Radio, but I wish we could show this stuff.
I agree. I mean,
really cool.
This is a really visual show thing. But I think you're doing a really admirable job, both of you, of being able to describe these things. But what I like about that, Cynthia, is there is the artistic part of it, which is this idea of you're trying to get some sort of expression, some sort of image.
Right.
Some sort of, you're part of what you're creating on the stage, right?
Absolutely.
At the same time, you're having to get control of the physics.
Completely. You know, the thing of it is all the physics have to be in service to the art. So the thing is if somebody goes out there in a stage and you say you're doing a piece that is, the experience for the audience has to be transformational. And if someone is on the stage and they are not doing it properly and say they fall off, they wobble on their pirouette, then it takes the audience out of this illusion. Mm-hmm. It breaks the illusion. So you can't have that. That's just, that can't happen. It has to be perfect so mm-hmm. that the audience can be transformed and they're not thinking, oh, well, that dancer, fell off of her point or she slipped on her pirouette. I mean, the whole thing is in service to creating this transformational experience for the audience.
Yeah, and that puts it in contrast, and you said this earlier, to a sport like skating. Skating has both, but you're graded often in skating, not only the form, but you're also graded on how many times you can turn. Mm-hmm. They were counting them. That's a little different because there you're trying to push out a little further than maybe you should and you fall. In yours, you don't want to break that illusion by falling. So it's...
No, but you still have to be a risk taker. So you have to have this, you have to have the technique so ingrained that you can take a risk so it's not boring.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you spend time? I'm just curious. Do you spend time with people on recovery of that? In other words, you're on stage, you do fall. How do you gracefully come back?
Oh, yes, that is a very good question. You get up and you have to, ideally, you work it in. So that you don't, so that you can get back into the illusion. So you work it in into somehow the choreography, or you just get up and keep going. Because mishaps happen all the time.
Sure.
And so you just keep going. You just get up and keep going. I mean, people have broken limbs on stage before and gotten up and kept going. And it's amazing what you learn. That's part of your stagecraft.
Wow.
That's one thing that I'm very glad physicists don't have to do is physics in front of an audience. Because of course, making mistakes is, again, it's part of the deal. You have to mess up. If you're never messing up, you're not challenging yourself. You're not doing anything as difficult as you could. So you're going to mess up, but we get to do it in private.
Yeah, well, I know.
Or just with a few close colleagues.
Unless you're demonstrating physics to public and then.
Yes, well, a public demonstration is a different deal. That's not research, but it sure is. It is fun. and things do go wrong for sure.
Yeah. I'm curious, when we're talking about the spin and we're talking about, there's that excruciating thing having had two daughters as dancers of toe shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are they designed on purpose to give you a point to spin on? Or what's the point of those?
Well, they have a hard box that is shaped around the top of your foot. And then they have what's called the shank that goes like the instep, the insole, and that's supportive. But you know, you have to have tremendously, you know, this is where you really have to understand the mechanics of the body to find even what we call, when you go up on point, that's called a releve, to even do the releve without damaging yourself. And talk about finding your center of mass, you know, then it all changes when we get that extra 2 inches to go up onto the point.
Was it created mostly though for a look of
yes,
it was elevation and
well, and during the 18th century, the Romantic era, it was all the ballets were about an ethereal female lead that, you know, that the male was sort of dreaming about, the unattainable female, and that and so the point shoe was developed so that there would be an even lighter, more ethereal look.
So that leads me to a really simple question for both of you, and that's then, without that, then obviously you could do a pirouette without that, without toe shoes, because
you do it on your, right? You do it on the ball of your foot.
On the ball of your foot. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, how do you overcome the surface friction that's between the foot and the surface you're on?
Oh, it has to be just right. If it's too slick, you're going to wipe out. And if it's too sticky, you're going to ruin your knees. And so, you know, and you can't get, so the floor is very important in dance, very important.
Mm-hmm. And the shoes have to match it.
This is
one of the things we teach in physics, is that the friction between two surfaces depends on both surfaces.
Interesting. Well, that's true, because I know that a lot of times in contemporary contemporary dance, we use either barefoot or sometimes we use socks. And I know that, I never thought about that, because I always wet the socks so that there's just enough stick to the floor, so I'm not slipping. And I always think about how the surface of the floor, not how what I'm wearing, is affecting
right. The
surface of the floor.
But if you went out and tried to use the same footwear, whether it was barefoot or socks or toe shoes, and you brought them onto a shag carpet, it would be a very different experience, or a hockey rink.
Right.
So I'm really intrigued, Andy. So it really is, so often I've learned in my years of looking at physics that there's this idea that two things are happening, and that is that it's not only the surface, but it's also the surface touching the surface.
The touching, yeah. So friction comes from two things. So we actually teach this as a first approximation, and most of what students learn in physics classes, even for the first several years of college, is a series of successively accurate approximations. But the first approximation that we teach, which is pretty good, is that the friction between two surfaces depends on how hard they are pressed together, and then some number that we call the coefficient of friction, which depends on both materials. So two pieces of ice pressed together with some force will have less friction than two pieces of rubber pressed against each other with the same force.
Mm.
But then if you fix the, if you say, all right, we're just going to go with two pieces of wood, the friction goes up and up and up as you press them harder and harder together.
Yeah, and I think that this is kind of everything what you're talking about with the foot, like what the foot is encased in or not encased mm-hmm. in, and the surface of the floor. This is everything on how you gauge how much force you need
mm-hmm.
to execute a step.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know, is that friction between the foot and the floor. And, you know, after a while, you can just step onto the floor and immediately know what you're going to need to do to work with this floor and this surface.
That's fascinating. And by the way, Cynthia, I have heard, but I don't know any of the details, that in different venues, the floor has a different springiness.
Oh, yes.
As well as a different friction. Tell me about that. What do you feel as a dancer?
Well, most companies now carry their own floor with them, like wherever they go. Like we have a floor that we lay down at Clues Hall when we do our performances, and it's a sprung floor. Mm-hmm. So there is a give. There's a little bit of a give. And then you lay a surface over it called a Marley surface, and you tape it down. You have these big rolls of this, and you tape it down, and then the floor is ready to go. But the sprung floor is very important because it prevents a lot of injuries, especially. And you know, dance has gotten more and more demanding. The technique is more demanding, and the pyrotechnics, you know, the tricks and all of those things, it's much more athletic in some ways than it used to be. And to really not get injured all the time, you have to have a good floor.
It needs to be a little bouncy, not so you'd see it, but
you can see it a little teeny bit. It's not like a gymnastics floor at all, but it's you know, but it's wood, but it does have, it's not set on concrete. It's set above. It floats. It floats above the surface of a hard floor, and then it does have a teeny bit of give.
Can you actually get just a little bit more altitude, if you will? I mean, on a jump or something.
No question. Yeah.
You get a little extra out of that, because in that plié, you settle down. You can compress the floor just a touch, and then it gives you a little energy back.
Yes, it does. It's a big difference, actually, than just doing it on a hard surface, on a concrete floor.
Yeah, so the give of that surface, right? Because you're pushing it down, you're exerting force on it, but then it's going to release that energy, right? Am I right, Andy?
Yeah, exactly. When you compress the floor a little bit as you push down against it, and then it gives you that energy back. I mean, if people think of a trampoline, this is not that extreme. So of course you're not getting any 30-foot jumps off a sprung floor, but it's the same principle at work. Get a little extra bounce from the floor.
This is all wonderful. We're talking with Cynthia Pratt and Andy Gavern about the physics of dance. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with Cynthia Pratt and Andy Gavern about the physics of dance. And when we left for the break, we were just talking about the floor pushing back. And I think that's just such an interesting concept. I remember when I first took physics in high school, I thought, that is the weirdest thing. When I walk on a floor, it has to push back. And so, Andy, can you help me? Even still, it seems like a weird thing.
Sure. I mean, if you think about walking on ice, that's the case where the floor is only pushing up on you. But it's very hard to get anywhere if you try to just go forward the way you normally would. Your feet go out from under you, you fall down because you haven't got enough friction. So when you interact with the floor, you're interacting with it in two directions. You're, well, really three. There's front to back and side to side. Those are the horizontal directions. And then there's up and down. So when you do the plié that Cynthia was talking about, you lower yourself and then push down against the floor propels you up. When you walk or shift side to side, you're pushing forward or back or to the sides with your feet, and the friction with the floor is moving you. Again, if you push to the right, the friction with the floor moves you to the left. If you push back with a foot, friction with the floor allows you to move forward. So if you don't have friction, you can't move horizontally. And if you don't have a solid floor, well, then it's like trying to stand on water and you can't move vertically. You just fall.
Wow. So
yeah, I mean, all of this is just, dance is just an extreme version of all of that.
Right.
You know, it's taking that basic principle and then developing it in all of these beautiful ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, dance, this is what you were saying earlier. It's constrained by physics. So the same rules apply to dance as apply to walking or running or jumping informally, let's say. Mm-hmm. But then you want to refine it and perfect it so that you're really pushing the boundaries of what's possible and doing it in the most elegant and expressive way as physics allows.
Mm-hmm. So Cynthia, this is really interesting. So when you combine some art forms, which we've all seen, like a cabaret, musical theater, we combine, things with opera, and we stick dancers on there. A lot of times people, including stage managers, think that dancers are really a pain in the neck because they're worrying about the floor, right? There's reason to worry about the floor.
Oh, yeah, no, there's, you know, and dancers are really obsessed with this. and dancers are, they are, of all of the artistic forms, I know that they're probably the most kind of fixated on certainly their anatomy and their experience of the floor, for sure. Yeah, the floor, they're very picky about that because it is important. It is important. And, you know, all of those other, you know, when you're talking about the musical theater and, you know, all those, the opera, like where they have dancers, all of those dancers are all trained in the same way. Huh. You know, they're all trained in the same way. They all have that, that knowledge of how to do something with the friction and with that push off the floor. You know, really anatomically, there's just not very many variants on how you can do that.
That's really interesting. So we're somewhat limited in it. Back on that push on the floor. So would it be true that like a male larger dancer, are they exerting more energy to the floor?
I would imagine so. They have to get themselves up off the ground. Right. So, you know, they have a heavier load to carry.
Yeah.
But they're usually, you know, it depends on their musculature. If they have a heavier musculature, then they're stronger too.
So their anatomy compensates for that size difference.
Right, right.
Actually, if I can take this just a little beyond the human dance, jumping is one of those things that, if you think about it, is almost universal among animals. If you look at mammals, say, from mice to not to elephants, for reasons that I could get into, but to very large animals. I mean, tigers, lions, whatever, 400 or 500 pound critters. The ability to jump is pretty much, we can all jump a few feet. You can look at almost any other quantity, like heart rate or body temperature or running speed. And there are very, very wide variations. But jumping, it's a few feet. no matter how big a critter you're talking about. And that's exactly because of the kind of thing Cynthia was just talking about. To jump, to exert more force on the floor, you need heavier muscles and thicker bones.
Uh-huh. Yes, you do.
But then having heavier muscles and thicker bones, that's now a bigger load to lift.
Yeah.
And those two things cancel out pretty much.
Well, you know, it is interesting because, you know, there we have, you know, in dance, of course, there are some people who are jumpers, mm-hmm. and there are some people who have like maybe a prettier line, like there's a prettier, you know, there's a line of the leg mm-hmm. that is sort of the ballet aesthetic, if we're talking about ballet. But there are some people who are natural jumpers. I was always a natural jumper. And I had that strength to, and the sort of the coordination between the legs and the torso that could propel me mm-hmm. upward, but, or forward. But there are dancers that no matter what, they don't have the anatomical makeup to mm-hmm. really get off the floor. It's right. very difficult for them.
Oh yeah, and I don't mean to say that there's no variation. There's certainly mm-hmm. variations, for instance, if you look right. again back to mammals between cats, which are great jumpers versus, I don't know, bears, which are not great jumpers. But the variation is relatively, you know, you could say, well, you know, we're talking about jumping 6 feet versus jumping a foot or two. If you compare that to running speed between a cheetah and a mouse, say, right. It's really a much more constricted range.
Right.
So even
right.
a jumper that, you know, a dancer that you would call a pretty poor jumper, still can jump.
That's right.
So when we think, I'm thinking of dances that I've seen, when I think about them, and I'm curious because we've been talking about pirouettes are also done by men, but they were typically done, you know, by women to create that kind of illusion that you were talking about. But men do these incredible jumps from off stage or from side, or mm-hmm. there was a famous dancer, Nijinsky, who apparently could jump through a window, you know,
oh, yeah.
and control his body going through it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we're talking about something a little different there.
I mean, actually, he was really famous for his jump, that he had this, there's something called in ballet called ballon, which means the ability to go up and give the illusion of sort of hovering there for a split uh-huh. second before they come down. And Nijinsky was famous for that. That he had that ability. And that also has to do with where, if you are doing, say, what we call a grand jeté, which is where that split leap, where you can take both legs at the same time and sort of take them both up, and it takes your torso higher. So you have that illusion of hovering for a second.
Right. Michael Jordan was also famous for that.
Oh,
basketball court. And you have it, you describe the physics beautifully, Cynthia.
Good.
What you're doing is you jump. And when you jump, this is a fundamental physics thing. Your center of mass follows an exact parabola. And you can't change that. Your center of mass is going to take a certain trajectory. But when you raise your legs like that, it gives the illusion that you're floating, because you've shifted where your center of mass is in relation to the rest of your body. So it flattens the top of the trajectory and gives that hovering appearance.
Oh my goodness, that is so interesting.
So that's really interesting, because that means that if you jumped without lifting your legs, you probably jump the same as if you lift your legs in terms of the parabola, the height.
Right.
The difference here is the illusion that's created
uh-huh.
by mm-hmm. lifting arms and legs and making you look like you're floating more, which I think is the real essential thing in dance, is the illusion that you create through the entire body, beyond the physics of what you can do, it's that whole thing to look like everybody's lighter than air, you know, floating. Curious. So floating is interesting. What are the other illusions, Cynthia, that you try to create on stage?
Well, I think that one of those things, you know, if we're talking, I mean, point work really does create a lot of illusions. You know, there's the what we call the bourée, which is where you have the feet tight together, and then it seems as though you're skimming across the floor. And that's, you know, where you're, where you have these little tiny steps, but they're so tiny that you only get this illusion of the dancer moving seamlessly sideways. And that is also to get that, to create that feeling of spirit and otherworldly quality.
Like the dancer in a music box.
Well, yeah,
which
she's
is
turning
like
around
pulled across the surface by,
but you go side,
by
you
a
go side or forward and back.
Right. Pulled by a magnet, but the dancer,
exactly.
Right. I mean,
exactly.
But you're trying to get this illusion of moving,
right?
So without you doing anything, your body
right.
moving.
So for example, in Swan Lake, you know, like the dancer is doing that and at the same time moving her arms to simulate flying. So we can't, you know, we don't want to see anything happening in the legs. We only see the illusion of this bird on the top.
Mm-hmm.
But actually the legs are moving very fast and in a very specific way to get that illusion.
So this reminds me a little bit of what magicians do, because I'm trying to exaggerate the upper body movement by moving that so that you take your eyes diverted away from the tiny little movements you might if you were really focused on my feet.
Oh,
that's a good point.
And so I wonder if, I bet some parts of choreography and dance are intended to take the focus and move it.
That's certainly a good point to think about. Of course, you know, one of the things in something like that, you know, the dancer's legs and feet are always the focal point too. So it's the whole entity, but the movement itself has an illusion that is created.
Wow.
And I think that then you have also, I think that in more contemporary techniques and modern, specifically the going to the floor, you know, then we get to a whole new planet, which is going to the floor. And how do you go down there and getting back up? We're not just talking about weight support on the feet anymore. We're talking about weight support anywhere, on your shoulders, on your side, on your back, you know, and you have to get down there and it's got to look completely, completely seamless. We can't see, we can't hear any kind of crashing bones or anything. And then, you know, it just has to be seamless to the floor. And so there's in modern class and in jazz class, we teach a lot about how to fall to the floor. It's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you don't want them slapping the floor and looking like a fall, because that wasn't the point.
No, it's just getting down to the low level and usually trying to do it as gracefully as possible. And that's a whole different thing.
Right. There's so much going on here. I mean, oh my God.
There is. And of course, the mechanics of getting down onto the floor and getting up off the floor are simple in one level, in the sense that, okay, your center of mass is going down, and then you need to bring it back up again. And it all involves changing the force between whatever part of you is touching the floor at the moment and the floor itself. You know, to get up, to rise up, you have to push down. To drop down, you have to relax and lighten the load on your feet just momentarily, just briefly. If you do it too quickly. If you just suddenly pick your feet up as fast as you can, you fall. And of course, it's possible to do that. If you're standing still and you're in good shape, you can jerk your feet up off the floor. And then a moment later, you'll crash down on your knees and hurt yourself. And it doesn't look good. So doing it elegantly is the issue for a dancer. Of course, falling is easy. I do it all the time. But getting onto the floor elegantly and expressively, and then getting back up, expressing something by the way you do it, that's art.
Andy, is energy transferred from the person moving down to the floor? Because that takes energy to get down there.
Interesting. This is a very confusing topic. So really, energy is the interaction between two things.
Okay.
In this case, the two things are your mass, the dancer's mass, and the earth. So what we call potential energy is an expression of how much energy is stored in the interaction between you and the earth. And when you get up off the floor, what you're doing is you're converting chemical energy in your muscles to potential energy between you and the earth. And if you push harder, you gain some speed too, and we call that kinetic energy. So the three kinds of energy that are floating around here so far are potential energy between you and the earth, kinetic energy, which has to do with your motion, and the energy stored in your body that comes from eating food. And you're converting energy among those three things. And every time you do it, you waste a little, and that waste is heat, and that's what makes the dancer hot.
Wow. Wow. This is so relevant to, I mean, things that I tell my students. I can't even tell you. I mean, even standing, we talk about feeling the energy of the floor coming up, and how do we feel the energy of the floor coming up? And you have to make sure that all of your joints are not locked, because the lock takes the energy, it blocks the energy flow through the entire organism. And then that's where you start from, on feeling the energy from the floor coming up into you.
Right. And that, you know, that's a somewhat looser form of energy than the way I'm using it. You know, I'm dividing it up into several different kinds of components, et cetera. You know, the ideas of force and energy are different to a physicist, but closely intertwined. Force can help convert energy from one form to another. But I do want to raise this issue of heat. You know, athletes deal with this, and I'm sure dancers must as well. As you exert yourself, as you convert chemical energy in your body into motion, you raise your body temperature, and you can't just do that arbitrarily. You get exhausted, quite literally. So you must need some airflow. You can't possibly dance as dramatically, as aggressively, I'm not sure what the right word would be, in a hot, humid room as you could in a cooler room, or with fans on, or other things like that.
Well, that's debatable. I mean, dancers really love that hot. They love the heat because they can stretch more. And, you know, and of course the stretch takes away from the strength, which is what you're talking about. But, you know, this thing about the heat, of course, warming up is really important and how they do that.
Sure.
But, you know, one thing, dancers, especially serious dancers, like the ones that I teach, I always have to hold them back because they overwork. because they like to generate that heat. They like to sweat. They like to be physical. They like to, so, and it sabotages the artistry sometimes. So we work with, they have to understand the tension flow in their body between working with your tension flow being bound or being free, which is, you know, one of them is more free, is more of a relaxed tension flow. And bound flow, you're engaging all your muscles, which sometimes shortens the movement. So, but they, you know, it's sometimes I have to work with them to get them away from pulling everything, their energy flow in, because they like that heat. They like all that energy. They like that feeling of working real hard and their muscles like going as full out as they can. That's not always appropriate in dance technique, you know?
Right. I guess it feels like you're doing something, and it feels, it does feel expressive and expansive, big.
Yeah, it does, but it doesn't always.
But it doesn't always work with the.
Right. And there is, Cynthia, you do, I mean, some dancers are on stage for a very long time. You do have an endurance issue where you do want to conserve some energy.
Exactly.
In it, you don't want to, just because it's feeling good for a while, you don't want to blow it all out in the form, because every time you're putting that out, as Andy just said, you're also generating a waste product of heat energy.
Right.
And that heating energy, while it may make the muscles for a while feel good, it's going to be a drain on your entire system. So then you've got, like you said, then you've got the thing. This is just amazing. I hope that our listeners are having as much fun as we are. we encourage our listeners to explore further in conversation with other, any of the ideas we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Cynthia Pratt and Andy Gavron about the physics of dance, including amazing ways dancers use their bodies and physics to create illusions. And when we went from the break, we were talking about heat and heat energy and those kinds of things. One of the interesting things that I wanted to ask you, Cynthia, in this is there's also the idea has been pushed down that it only can be a younger dancer that can be on stage and that kind of thing. But I think what's interesting is that dancers that are more mature, have had a lot of experience, they often can create these illusions in ways that the younger dancer who's fiery can't. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, an older dancer has a more, usually has a more sophisticated understanding of movement. And a physical understanding of movement, because, you know, oftentimes you can understand something intellectually, but you haven't incorporated it physically yet. And so, yeah, they're two different skill sets, kind of. Like you said, the younger dancers tend to be more fiery, more passionate, but certainly there are dancers that go well into their well into their 40s and even 50s that still have tremendous energy.
Yeah, wow. Andy, as you look at dance and you hear all the things that Cynthia is talking about, what kinds of things are you intrigued about with that?
Well, I'm intrigued by all of this stuff. I mean, we talked a little bit about friction at the beginning, and that was fascinating. And we've talked about forces and energy. So I'd like to throw in another issue, which may bring us back to the beginning to spin, which is torque. Torque is a quantity that physicists love to talk about. And it's one that's familiar sort of as a word to a lot of people, because you hear about it when you buy a car, you know, or you choose a truck, and which one's got more torque, and you want to be able to tow a load or something like that. But torque is also what allows a dancer to spin, or to get, when working with a partner, to get a spin going between the two of them. You see skaters do that as well.
Can you explain torque to me, you know, sort of in layman's terms, so I can sort of relate this?
Yeah, so in layman's terms, torque is how hard you're twisting something.
Okay.
So I think, for instance, when you were right early on, when you were talking about getting into a pirouette,
mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Dropping down with your feet in fourth position, and then as you push up, you're also twisting.
It's the torque, yes.
That twist, that's the torque.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And from a calculational point of view, and I don't want to get into the formulas here, but a torque is a force over a distance. That's why when you try and tighten something with a wrench, if you need to twist harder, one thing you can do is get a longer wrench so you can hold it further away.
Okay, this is really interesting, because, you know, I have to look at this. I'm going to have to look at this on my students so mm-hmm. that I can sort of see how that works. When we're talking about a pirouette, like the shorter dancers who mm-hmm. have sort of shorter, lower center of gravity, mm-hmm. they tend to be better turners than the longer, taller, long-limbed dancers.
Okay.
And I wonder if that has anything to do with this or not.
It's certainly possible. So as they rise out of that plié, they're pushing, and they're pushing with their feet around their axis. So they've got to generate that force around.
Uh-huh.
That's the uh-huh. torque. And uh-huh. it may be that certainly the amount of torque they can generate depends on how far apart their feet are in that position.
Interesting.
And it could be that just a few inches of difference in how far apart they're placed could change the amount of spin that they can generate.
Well, now that's interesting. There's a very famous dancer, male dancer, Daniel Simkin, and he takes a very wide preparation. He's a uh-huh. spins like a top. Uh-huh. And he takes a very, very wide preparation before he turns.
From a physics point of view, that makes complete sense to me. Oh,
it does. Okay.
It does, yeah.
So he's taking that from that wide stance, right? Mm-hmm. Which there's a lot of energy put into holding that wide stance. He's taking that, and when he pulls that in there to make the spin, right, Andy? Mm-hmm. And he's converting that extra distance.
Right. So he may actually
into the
just one thing is he's getting more torque because he's able to generate friction with the floor farther from the axis. So that's going to generate more torque. But then once he, as he comes up and begins and gets into the end of the spin, he can also bring his feet in closer, which in technical terms is reducing his moment of inertia. It's that same thing of bringing the arms in or bringing the legs in. That also is going to accelerate the spin.
Uh-huh. Which we've all done not all anymore, because I took them away from most playgrounds, but we used to spin on playground merry-go-rounds.
Yeah. Right.
And we would get it going by leaning way out.
Right.
Right. And then everybody, one, two, three, we'd come in and the thing would just
come into the middle. Right. Yes. That's exactly what's going on there.
Oh, that's so interesting.
That is really an interesting thing, that idea of the foot position of friction. And then you get, you just layered up like five or six different things in physics that are concepts that are going on in that one move.
Well, I think that that move, I think that a pirouette is really one of the more, I mean, when we're talking about physics, that's one that has it all, because, you know,
it really does,
you know, fourth position, when you do a turn from fourth position and you have the feet apart, it's much easier to execute that turn than when you do it from fifth position where the feet are together, you know, and that's really tough.
Yeah.
That's really tough to get the spin from the fifth, from the closed position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
It's amazing it can be done at all, frankly.
Yeah. Yes, we do superhuman things.
Uh-huh. You do. And, you know, another thing that is really fascinating in that sense of being superhuman is you create the illusion by staying within the bounds of physics. And it looks fabulous, and it's expressive. But if you go too far beyond, and now I'm thinking about things that they do in the movies, if you go beyond what's reasonable, people can tell.
Yes.
That's why martial arts movies look the way they do. Mm. When you put wires on people, it's almost impossible to make it look real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't, because people have a sense, you know, we've lived on this earth for, as individuals for years, we tend to live years to decades. And as a species for much, much longer. And your brain and your optical system work together, and you know what looks right.
Right.
If something looks really wrong, it's just unbelievable. You can tell that it's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why it's hard for me to watch any kind of movie that has dance in it, because they've spliced it and diced it and, you know, made it. And it does, you know, it's you can tell right away, this is not.
Right.
This isn't real.
You know, it's no, professors the early, are always like this. Right. Physicists, you know, when we watch space movies and, you know, that kind of thing, it's the same thing. You look at it and you say, it wouldn't do that.
You know, and that's interesting, because the early animation of movement, which tries to follow the other, you know, before the invention of much more rigorous physics engines, which are mathematically based on the formulas, you know, you could tell right away, you'd go, there's no way that ball's bouncing correctly, or that.
Oh yeah, you're talking about like computer animation.
Yeah, because it's gotten way, way better. I mean.
Oh yeah.
It's been
a few years, and I don't know whether he's still there, but for a long time, the technical director at Pixar was a physicist.
Oh.
He was
someone that with a background in fluid mechanics.
And could apply and that to.
I saw him give a talk that had just amazing computer facilities. And of course, other movies. I think we talked about this once before, Mark, the movie Interstellar.
Yes.
They used a tremendous amount of computational physics power to make that look like it really would look. That's not something that people are familiar with, but what a black hole looks like. But they did a great job of making it look the way it really would if you could be near a black hole. But just making people look like they really move, it's, if you move into the realm of animation, it's very hard.
We've gone through another hour of a show, and there's still more things that I want to know and that I'm sure that you have to tell. I want to thank Cynthia Pratt and Andy Gavern for helping us explore it. You know, it amazes me at the way we can bring art, science, community all together and have these conversations where we all are learning something, but then we can get excited. Until next week, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.